Cigarette Girl, the world.
His synthesizer arrangement of Baby Let Me Bang Your Box was a minor club hit in Germany.
Coco LaCroix, Procure, Save the Robots.
At the time, Cookie was working as Ugly George's personal assistant. Ugly George was this guy who would go around, he had this public access show, and he'd ask women to take their clothes off on camera. Go around the city, going up to women. A precursor to the kind of weird internet celebrities you have nowadays, but back then it was crazy. Cookie thought the whole thing was fabulous, really DIY. If it doesn't exist, make it. Guitars on top of a beatbox? Good, go do it.
One time this guy he grew up with was visiting, Fudgy I think his name was, he's a big guy. We was standing outside CB's and he said, you know, one day this is just gonna be condos for rich people. We laughed, of course. How could you not, the way the Bowery was in those days? He was wrong, of course. CB's is a clothing store for rich people.
It was November 1984, the night Reagan got reelected. He was going off. Fuck the Great American Songbook. Give me the Great American Mixtape.
Jeff Chambers, accountant, 99 Records.
Cookie was always going from one job, and then he'd get fired, and he'd find another gig. Somehow he stumbled into a job working for the vending company. It serviced the candy machines at NYU dorms. It's how he met Rick Rubin. Rubin got his hand stuck in one machine trying to steal some ho-hos. That's how he met. Cookie brought the jaws of life.
It was Cookie Puss's idea to put that little white kid into Run DMC's video for Rockbox. He was like, this record is going to take over the country. They needed a Trojan horse, is what he called it. Watching MTV, those kids out there in the Midwest, they'll see this little white boy hanging out with these B-boys, and it'll just seem natural.
He was really into the idea of that little white kid, sure. He wrote a TV pilot for a Saturday morning cartoon show called The Amazing Adventures of Run DMC and Jim Jim. He flew out to L.A. and everything. Nothing ever came of it.
He said, the new style is every style that has come before recombined. You know that story about how everyone who saw the Ramones started a band? Well, everyone who sniffed glue with Cookie started on a genre-bending musical odyssey.
Like who?
I didn't agree to talk to you so I could be attacked.
What actually happened that night, the Cookie Puss met Beastie Boys, remains a mystery. Something went down. Everyone agrees on that. Now, of course, everyone says they were there at Downtown Beirut that night, like Woodstock, or the Sun Ra Sonic Youth show at Summer Stage, or the Shoot the Hostages show where Dev Tremor stapled the Chihuahua to his chest. History.
Oh, to have been a fly in the wall.
It was not recorded, obviously. There were no photographs, but after that night, everything was different.
I don't think they ever met again.
In a certain sense, he was their Pete Best.
What sense would that be?
Get out of my house!
For a long time after, in certain trendy downtown art circles, speaking to Cookie Puss was slang for smoking marijuana. You know, Chiba, since Amila.
I don't know what happened to him.
He started hanging with this rough crowd, the whole downward spiral thing, hitting the hard stuff, hot fudge, sprinkles.
I heard he melted.
The last time I saw him was at the Ritz, when it was still the Ritz and not that club or whatever it is now. It was Beastie Boys and Murphy's Law. License to Ill had just come out, but it hadn't broken yet. Party was maybe a video already, but it hadn't blown up. It was a great show, a really mixed crowd, the way clubs were in those days. B-boys, what you call white hipsters nowadays, teenagers, punks, club heads. All these crazy cats, mosh pits, bringing them all together, like magic. And there was Cookie Puss, just standing there in the middle of it, smiling his head off. It was a great night. It was one of those New York nights that stays with you no matter what happens later.
We lost touch after that. You grow up, settle down, don't stay up all night anymore. Life happens.
Back to outer space, I'm telling you, his work here was done.
British Airways by Adam Horovitz. So one day I'm at my friend Tammy's apartment. Tammy Toy, sister of downtown supermodel Terry Toy. It's 1983. I'm supposed to be in school, but I'm not. I'm at Tammy's apartment on 18th Street. We're just hanging out. The TV's on, but it's sort of in the background. All of a sudden, I hear our song, Beastie Revolution, the B-side of the Cookie Puss single, playing from the background. Wait, what? No way. I rush to the TV, and turn it up, and... oh, shit! That's our fucking song! Playing in an ad for British Airways. I was freaking out. Did that shit really just happen? Yes. Our song really did just play on a commercial for an airplane on TV. I have no idea what happened in the ad. It was a total blur. In slow motion, it happened in an instant. I called Yout, Kate, and Mike right away. Yo! How crazy is that? Wait up. You can't just use someone's music for an ad without getting permission. I mean, we were new to the industry, but shit, British Airways? Where's our money? Mike's mom had a friend who had a friend who knew someone in a law firm, and they said that there was this young guy that had just started, fresh out of law school, and that he'd be perfect for us to talk to. So we did. He appeared to be basically our age, but seemed like he was trying really hard to look and act like a grown-up. He contacted the lawyers for British Airways, and I guess they realized that they fucked up and were quick to pay us a settlement. Adam, Mike, Kate, and I got 10 grand each. Besides random jobs here and there, a few dollars playing gigs, and my job at the ice cream store. Did I mention that I worked at an ice cream store? This was the first real money I'd ever had. Long dollars. This shit was huge for me. I never had a nice guitar, and so fuck it. I'm gonna get one. The one I'd wanted forever was a black Rickenbacker. The same one that Paul Weller from The Jam played. I'd been eyeing a used one at Rogue, this music store my mom's friend owned. It cost $250. So when I got my British Airways money, I went up there with exactly $250. I had definitely never had that much cash in my pocket before. When I got there, I was all ready to get the cool Paul Weller Rickenbacker, but I saw this drum machine they were selling for the same price. By then, we were all really into rap music, and all the best new rap records were using drum machines, Rockin' It, F-R-E-S-H, and Sucker MCs were for sure made with a drum machine, so I wanted one. I had no idea that we would actually ever really make rap music, but for some reason I said fuck it. I mean, I already had the Hondo guitar my mom and her friends gave me for my 12th birthday, and it worked just fine, so I bought the drum machine instead. I'm not sure why, but this particular drum machine drew me in. Maybe because it was selling for the exact amount of money I had in my pocket? Maybe it was the forces of nature, but this shit just looked really cool. No one I knew had a drum machine, and I wanted to have one. This one, the Roland TR-808. That same 808 later became the House 808 at Chungking Studio, where us, Run-DMC, LL Cool J, and a bunch of other rappers recorded. I can't believe the randomness of it all. The TV just happened to be on, and it was playing loud enough for me to hear the commercial. Us just fucking around having fun late one night at Yout's parents' friend's recording studio making stupid songs like Cookie Puss and Beastie Revolution would turn into me having the cash to buy the very drum machine that would later make the beat for songs like Brass Monkey, Run-DMC's Peter Piper, and a bunch more songs that you might know and enjoy. Another wild part of the British Airways thing was that later it turned out the person responsible for selecting our piece of music for that TV ad was this guy from a band called Hazy Fantasy. And just a couple years earlier, before I met Tammy and went to her apartment and heard this TV ad, I was a kid at home listening to the Hazy Fantasy record on my shitty Emerson brand turntable radio cassette entertainment system in my bedroom. I mean, how does this type of stuff happen? This shit should be in a book, right?
The MG by Adam Horovitz, read by Nadia Dejani. Yauch was the first to leave the city. He went to Bard College in upstate New York. He didn't really leave, though, because it seemed like he came back home every weekend. I didn't know much about his life up there other than he lived in a dorm, and that there was a kid who had a radio show, and Yauch threw a smoke bomb into the studio during his show because he thought it would be really funny, and that the kid would think so, too. But the kid really didn't think it was funny and went on a two-minute on-air cursing rampage about Yauch, which actually made the thing way more funny. Damn you, podcasts. Why weren't you around then?
Yauch actually played us a tape of it back then, and it was fucking funny as shit.
Yauch set up a show for us at Bard, and so we all went up there a few months into his freshman year. We also just wanted to see what college was like. I remember us being so psyched that there was this mess hall kind of place where the food was free. You mean we can just take as many of these mini boxes of Rice Krispies as we want and we won't get in trouble? Yauch was basically like, yeah, no one gives a shit about the cereal. They're pretty content with the tuition money they're getting. Yauch was 2 years older than me, and so he did a lot of stuff first. Not only leave New York City, but also own a car. Yauch had some money saved and bought a beat-up old black MG sports car from the 60s. It was so cool. Well, it looked really cool. And when you were riding in it, it was awesome. But as far as dependability and safety and stuff like that, it was not so much like, you know, up to date. I remember that Yauch was very particular about starting it up and letting it sit for a long while before he would drive off in it. I know it's freezing outside and the heat doesn't work in here, but just wait. The first time he drove his new MG down to the city, he went around trying to find people to show it off to, but no one was around. He drove to my apartment, but I wasn't home. My mom was, though. So Adam drove her around the entire circumference of the island of Manhattan. Just the two of them. Cruising. When I finally got home and my mom told me about it, it made me so happy. My mom never learned how to drive, and I know she loved being in cars. What it must have meant to her to have her little son's friend pick her up and take her out on the town. But that was Yauch. He wasn't doing anyone any favors. He just loved living and sharing experiences. And the same went for my mom.
DJ Double R and His World-Famous Bubble Machine by Michael Diamond. Summer 1983. Cookie Puss was getting played in clubs. This was some exciting shit to us. We wanted to start performing the song live. Never mind that we were a hardcore band with zero experience at playing anything with a funky beat. What were we going to do for the vocal part? Recreate a prank phone call? No, but like one of those inspirational calendars will tell you, great adversity provides great opportunity.
We actually did recreate a prank phone call once, at our ill-fated Studio 54 gig. We did a pretend prank phone call with our friend Keisha Benvenuto backstage on a mic, acting like the Carvel lady. At the same gig, Mike almost got us beat up for saying something about the mafia, and then Julian Schnabel and Rene Ricard saved our lives. It's a long story.
We decided to start rapping. The decision probably would have happened one way or another. We were totally burnt on hardcore and obsessed with hip-hop. By the time of Cookie Puss, we had enough of a hardcore audience and were kind of settled into the bass, drums, guitar, vocals format that it took us a while to fully let go. Instead, we started with a half-step. At future shows, we'd play a 20-minute hardcore set, then bring on a DJ, and then do a hip-hop set. So, we needed to find a DJ and to teach ourselves how to MC. To do the latter, we bought every new rap 12-inch as it came out. There still weren't that many, like maybe one every 2 weeks, and we would play them on repeat, memorizing every single word, phrase, cadence, and ad-lib. Actually, on repeat wasn't even in our vocabulary back then. We'd have to run over to the turntable at the end of every 12-inch, pick up the needle, and drop it back at the beginning. We did this over and over again, dancing around and rapping the whole time.
I noticed that Mike has mentioned dancing several times. Did you know that he studied at Juilliard and the Joffrey?
Inevitably, we would try to scratch using our consumer turntables. This did not end well. You would trash the needle, and if you went too crazy, might fuck up the record or even the turntable motor. None of this could be done on our parents' nicer living room stereos. One, they wouldn't have it. Rap music in the living room? Have you lost your mind? And two, that shit would have been way too embarrassing. I mean, here we were, teenagers, trying to learn how to dance and rap. We're talking seriously awkward experimentation. Privacy required. Bedrooms only. Meanwhile, cut to interior, a high-end bohemian loft in Soho. Day. Cutting-edge modern art hangs on pristine white walls. A tall, punk rock teen with a limp mohawk talks on a wall telephone in an open kitchen. This is Nick Cooper, downtown punk rock private school kid, on the phone with his friend, Adam Horovitz, who's recently given himself the name The King Ad-Rock. Cooper.
Dude, I'm telling you, he is the guy. He can DJ, he has all the equipment, turntables, PA, drum machine, he even has a fucking bubble machine, everything.
The King Ad-Rock, off-screen, muffled from the other end of the phone line.
Hold up, bubble machine?
Cut to... Nick leads Adam and me over to NYU's Weinstein Dormitory in the middle of Greenwich Village, just off Washington Square Park. Weinstein is an institutional building from the Robert Moses era of New York City construction. Soulless, efficient, generic, brick on the outside, painted cinder block, linoleum floors, and fluorescent lighting on the inside. We're greeted by the dorm receptionist at the front desk. He's a short, stocky guy with thick beard and thicker New York accent. We'd later find out his name, Rick Minello. Remember that. He calls up to the dorm room to announce our arrival and issues us passes. This is already some next-level shit for us. High school kids hanging out in a college dorm in the general vicinity of college-age girls. We get to the room and knock. The door is opened by a heavy-set dude with sleepy eyes and long hair that kind of hangs in his face. It seems clear that he's just rolled out of bed. He looks like a guitarist in some metal band, except he's wearing these weird leather gloves that zip up, which totally creeps us out. This couldn't possibly be him. Yep, that's him. One entire side of his teeny dorm room is filled with a complete PA. Surin Vega speaker cabinets with those huge folded horns. Two Technics 1200 turntables, ones you could actually scratch with, a drum machine, and yes, boys and girls, a bubble machine.
He did not have a bubble machine. Nick just told us that he did. The art crowd loves bubbles, as do two-year-old children. But when we met Rick, he said that he had access to a smoke machine.
I definitely remember a bubble machine.
There was no bubble machine.
Well, I happen to have Rick Rubin right here.
I did, in fact, have access to bubbles. The dorm had a machine for parties, as I recall. Seems strange, but it's true.
We hired him on the spot. We didn't even know yet if he could DJ or not, but he had the gear. That was enough for us. And that's how we came to work with DJ Double R, known to his friends as Rick Rubin. Rick was an interesting cat. He was from an entirely different world from us, Long Island, a true suburban kid, complete with doting, overly protective parents and an unbridled affection for AC/DC and Zeppelin and metal. Turned out that he'd also been part of the New York hardcore scene. We'd seen many of the same shows, including that storied Black Flag show at the Peppermint Lounge, and he'd been in an arty, hardcore-adjacent band called Hose. And like us, Rick had also moved on to hip-hop. He'd been put in charge of dorm entertainment at Weinstein, which apparently came with a budget, and he promptly used it to hire DJ Jazzy J to spin at parties there. That was a huge deal to us, that he even knew a real hip-hop DJ. He was also ahead of us on rap 12 inches because while we were going to Rock and Soul or Vinyl Mania to buy them, he was a member of a record pool. Record pools were a service where real DJs would pay a fee and get all the new releases ahead of time. Rick's dorm room soon became our new HQ, our new rat cage. We'd spend hours happily going through the fresh crate of records he'd get every week from the record pool. We listened to everything through his large PA speakers, really loud. This never seemed to bother people, though I have a vague memory that when we started hanging out, Rick had a roommate. Somehow, over the ensuing months, he just kind of vanished. No idea why. Who wouldn't want to live with a DJ in leather gloves who always had high school kids over to play hip-hop at full blast on a concert PA? We started to map out what the rap part of our live show might look like. We would go through records, all types of records, picking out breaks that we wanted to rap over. Everything from Trouble Funk to AC/DC to John Cougar Mellencamp. Whatever worked. That will always be one of the things that makes me fucking love hip-hop. It's equal opportunity. It'll take from any person or any source. Black, white, Latin, rock, soul, easy listening, jazz, funk, fucking polka, whatever and whomever. By any means necessary. It is all about finding any record that contained two bars of magic. We'd spend hours in Rick's dorm room, working on the faintest beginnings of our individual MC styles. Cue the missing montage from the 80s movie Fame. I'll always remember one of the things that Rick said about my rapping. Mike D needs to sound like he's working hard when he raps. Meaning for Yauk, the James Dean of the band, rapping was effortless, and it sounded like it. Yauk was a natural. He could effortlessly spit out a flawless recreation of Spoonie G or Frederick MC Count. For me, as Kumo D said, I go to work like a doctor. Rick picked up on that and would push me further towards exposing the sweat and effort. We each had our certain default style, and Rick as a producer recognized that.
I wanted to sound like Jimmy Spicer when we first started rapping. But after hearing myself fronting on the mic with a fake deep voice, like Jimmy Spicer or Melly Mel, I had to come up with something different, something that was more me. I had to admit that I'm not a low-voiced smooth talker. I'm more the whiny, upset, screaming type. So the adjustment was made, and I felt way more comfortable on the mic.
Rick would usually man the turntables, though sometimes Adam Horovitz would too. Regardless, all of us would shout out records or breaks that we wanted to hear, bobbing our heads and occasionally engaging the Shure SM58 microphone that was on hand. The first shows we did with a rap set were more like amateur talent shows. They were proper gigs at proper clubs, but we were really just trying to figure it out, dress rehearsal style. We play hardcore for 20 minutes or so as a band with our instruments, including Kate on drums. Then we'd leave the stage. Rick would start to scratch, and then all four of us would come back out as MCs. For those first few gigs, Kate would come out and MC with us. She was definitely way less into rap than the three of us were, but I'm not sure we ever had a real conversation with her about the idea of including her less. Instead, we just slowly began leaving her out of stuff, a turn of events sometimes encouraged by Rick, and we did so in the least communicative, read shittiest way possible. Our set would be a combo of our own rhymes and covers. We started dressing the part too, sporting fashion straight out of Delancey Street, pullover windbreakers, shell-toe Adidas with fat laces, jeans tapered and tight at the ankles. For one show at the Pyramid Club on Avenue A, we brought in Mackie, a graffiti artist friend of ours, to create a mural live behind us as we played. This seemed like a good idea until the paint fumes filled the stage and choked us, making it difficult to see or breathe, let alone rap. At one of our shows sometime around then, we were introduced to Danny Fields, a New York underground legend who had managed the Stooges and Ramones. We fucking idolized the Ramones, so I was really psyched to meet this guy. He was an unapologetically little dude that reeked of weed. I liked him already, but when he opened his mouth, I was devastated. Kid, this will never work. You're white kids trying to rap? No one will like you. White people will be scared, and black people will never accept you. So as Biggie Smalls said in Juicy, this album is dedicated to all the teachers that told me I'd never amount to nothing. Challenge accepted. We're gonna get that bubble machine, and we're gonna rock the world.
DJ Anita Sarko, The Kids. Read by Kim Gordon. Rock Lounge, 1981. An NYC club located in, what is now, Tribeca. For a visual, check out Downtown 81, a film that follows Jean-Michel Basquiat roaming around downtown Manhattan. At one point, he wanders into a rock lounge. The DJ perched above the dance floor is me. Jean often crashed on my couch during that time, so this was a regular part of his night crawl. I hated that place. I had only gone there from Mud Club, where I had been DJing because Howie Montag, who had been the door guy at Harrah's, the original rock disco, convinced me that we should leave our respective venues to make some real money before we joined Danceteria co-owner Rudolf Piper at his new venture, Pravda. Only open for one night, Pravda had been immediately shut down by the Soho Community Board. However, Howie was convinced it would soon reopen, and we'd only have to deal with Rock Lounge for a month or two. That seemed like an excellent plan. Rudolph underestimated the Soho Community Board. Pravda never reopened. So, here Howie and I were, stuck at this lame mud copycat club, lorded over by the slick-haired, thuggish Howard Stein and Eurotrash poster boy, Peppo Vanini, the pair who also co-owned Xenon, a Studio 54 clone. Original ideas were not their forte. Huh. I was miserable. I would end most nights bitterly playing Sister Europe by the Psychedelic Furs. Listen to the words, you'll understand. Shedding tears of frustration while Howie consoled me. Rock Lounge was, for me, rock bottom. Then one night, in trooped a swarm of underage teens. There was something Howie loved about them for long enough to forget to ask for IDs. One of the reasons why Howie was the platinum standard doorman was his singular taste. Howie could detect diamonds in the rough, no pun intended, and knew when to pretend age was not an issue. Last night, a DJ saved my life. In this case, it was the other way around. My full-blown existential crisis was happily interrupted as one after another of a seemingly endless train of fresh, adorable, friendly faces appeared at the top of the ladder to my nest, then descended, each greeting me and making requests. I've always hated people in my DJ booths and abhorred requests, but there was just something about them that was astonishingly unannoying. We made a deal. I would play the punk classics I had played at Mud if they would agree to remain on the dance floor while I played other sorts of music. I needed the floor filled in case Howard or Peppo walked by. Keeping a floor filled was an issue for me because I didn't play the hits and my methods were disconcerting to many. My style, contrary to other DJs, was to play a vast range of music rather than just one type. Most people thought I didn't know what I was doing and was just slapping on any old record without any thought. Usually the only people who understood the thread within my segues were musicians. And Larry Levin. Larry told me later that I was the DJ most like him because even though we play completely different music, we both like to engage in musical conversations with the dancers and fuck with their minds. And so the kids, as Howie and I referred to them, became regulars. Every night they would climb up, one after the other, to say hello and then do the same at the end of the night to say goodbye. And most important, thank you. No one had ever thanked me before. I adored them. Howie adored them. Howard didn't. Why do you let in those filthy little children? Howard would whine to Howie. Howard, the upperly mobile son of a mobster whose body had been found in Jamaica Bay minus his head, only approved of uptown preppies and debs, resplendent in their mini adult garb of suits and ruffles. These people acted entitled and rude and had the lamest musical taste you could imagine. The antithesis of these young fogies, the kids wore their regular, extremely casual street clothes to the club, and arrogance was not part of their collective personality. They looked and acted like the well-brought-up teens they were. Howard didn't get it. He was so deeply into appearances that he once eviscerated his wife, Tawn, in front of everyone because she failed to change from uptown clothing to downtown clothing when she went from Xenon to Rock Lounge one night. I think downtown meant that she was supposed to wear black and leather, or something like that. It didn't matter. Howie was so contemptuous of Howard's and Peppo's opinions that he just ignored them and kept letting the kids in. I would play the punk classics, X-ray specs, Sex Pistols, The Stranglers, Television, Susie and the Banshees, The Clash, The Ramones, The Dead Boys, The Saints, The Damned, Patti Smith, Richard Hell and the Voidoids. Newer punk, for the kids to thrash around to. Black Flag, the Cramps. I was happy to oblige because they kept their side of the bargain and remained on the floor as I played Power Pop, The Jam, The Go-Go's, Buzzcocks, Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers. Post-punk, P.I.L., Pere Ubu, Killing Joke, Joy Division, New Order, Echo and the Bunnymen, The Slits, 23 Skidoo, Teardrop Explodes, Pop Group, Gang of Four, The Fall, Clock DVA, New Wave, Adam and the Ants, The Brains, the aforementioned Psychedelic Furs, Simple Minds, Orchestra Maneuvers in the Dark, Human League, Bow Wow Wow, Blondie, The Cure, Talking Heads, The Pretenders, Devo, Elvis Costello, B-52s, Laurie Anderson, Yoko Ono. Anything on Z Records. Rock. Velvet Underground and Solo Lou, Solo Kale. Roxy Music and Solo Fairy, Solo Eno. The New York Dolls and Solo Johnny Thunders, Solo David Johansen. The Heartbreakers, Jane County, The Runaways. Bowie, Led Zeppelin, Marianne Faithful, Hendrix, The Doors, Sly and the Family Stone, John Lennon, Prince, The Dictators, Iggy and the Stooges, MC5, Susie Quattro, Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. A native Detroiter, I never tired of Detroit rock. No Wave, DNA, Lounge Lizards, Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, James White, Mars. New Romantics, Duran Duran, Visage, Spandau Ballet, Blue Rondo a la Turk, Technopop Roots, Suicide, Wire, Magazine, Kraftwerk, Cabaret Voltaire, Ultravox, Throbbing Gristle, Gary Numan, African, A Lot of Fela, particularly the live album with Ginger Baker on drums, Jazz, Thelonious Monk, Gil Scott-Heron, Louis Prima and Keely Smith. Funk, R&B. I loved the entire Parliament family, as well as James Brown, Aretha, Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, anything on Atlantic Stax, Michael Jackson, The Jacksons, Gap Band, Rick James, etc. Being from Detroit, I was sick of Motown. Vintage Oddities, Garage Rock, The Last Poets, Scott Walker, Spoken Word, The Weirder the Better. Early Rock and Roll Rockabilly, Wanda Jackson, Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bo Diddley, Buddy Holly, Eddie Cochran, Chuck Berry, etc. Reggae. I preferred the more psychedelic types, like Dr. Alimentado and Dub. Ska. Both the originals and the covers by the acts on Two Tone Records. And this new music called rap. Rap had entered the consciousness of the Mud Club due to the efforts of Fred Braithwaite, Fab Five Freddy, and Glenn O'Brien, then the music editor of Interview. Anything on Sugar Hill Records became part of my heavy rotation, as the rap kids from Uptown were brought downtown by Fred and Glenn to meet their kindred spirits at Mud. The Uptown and Downtown graffiti artists together found a home at Patty Astor and Bill Stallings' Fun Gallery, where they were finally given an inside space to exhibit at, magically transforming themselves from perceived criminals, defacement, vandalism, to artists. Whenever I would play anything besides Stiff Little Fingers and their ilk, the kids would usually form a raucous conga line. To morons like Howard Stein, seeing a dance floor engaged in this activity was fabulous. Uptowners considered the conga line to be a sign that a party was really happening. To downtowners, conga lines were considered so kitsch, they were the height of postmodern mockery. And so 1981 became 1982. On New Year's Eve in 1981, Rock Lounge booked Killing Joke at the insistence of the staff. We loved Killing Joke. Unfortunately, no one else did. I believe the Ritz had booked the Psychedelic Furs, who had a huge hit that week, so everyone went there. No one showed up at Rock Lounge. Because New Year's Eve is supposed to be such a huge money-making night, Howard retaliated by firing the entire staff, except me, the following day. Out of respect, he fired me the day after. I didn't really care. Unbeknownst to anyone, I was a trust fund kid, the horror, so I didn't have to worry about paying the rent. I was finally free of that horrible place. What I did care about was something else. I was told that the kids, having shown up at Rock Lounge to discover that I was no longer there, allegedly covered the bathroom walls with, "This place sucks," with that DJ, Anita. I have no idea if this was true, because obviously I never went back to check. I believed it at the time, and that cemented the love I had for them tenfold. Nothing speaks louder or truer than loyalty. I went on to Chase Park, a late-night hangout for the downtown fine arts crew, and Howie went to the Peppermint Lounge. The 1982 New Year's Eve act at Chase Park was a disco dolly named Madonna, whom no one had heard of. No one showed up. She was so awful. The staff accused the owner of receiving some backroom favors in order to have booked her. Howie was doing better at Peppermint Lounge, where, besides doing the door, he created and hosted the No Entientes Cabaret. The motto for No Entientes was, if it's good, it's great. If it's bad, it's better. By 1983, both Howie and I had landed at the second danceteria. Happy at last. Howie had decided he needed a co-host for the cabaret. I passed the audition because an owner got me so trashed on Long Island iced teas and Coke to calm my nerves. I simulated giving Howie a blowjob on stage. No Entientes is best known for being where the newest incarnation of Madonna, now styled and art directed by Maripol, one of the producers of Downtown 81. See how this all comes together? First performed Everybody, which was produced by danceteria DJ Mark Kamens. And to the delight of Howie, me, and just about everybody else, the kids under various guises and at various numbers became semi-regular performers at our cabaret. There was Grandmaster Jew, where three of them, the Adams and Mike, dressed in full Hasid drag and performed a rousing take on My Adidas called My Deli. Another time, a much larger group showed up and played children's instruments. I don't recall what the tunes were, but it was brilliant. And then there was a time they concluded their performance by upending the giant round table in front of the stage, drenching all the critics and other journalists who had been sitting there in a mess of cocktails, ice, and cups. These people were not amused. Howie and I were. And of course, Cookie Puss was loved by all. By 1985, even we referred to the kids as the Beasties. We never used the boys part when speaking of them. I continued to play once a week at Danceteria, but Howie and I had moved on to the Palladium, a massive arts-driven club that was a comeback vehicle for Studio 54's Steve Rebell and Ian Schrager. Howie was the chief door person, and I was the DJ for the Michael Todd room, the VIP room that I co-hosted with Rubel. The music I was playing between Danceteria and Palladium included Industrial, Skinny Puppy, Leather Nun, SBK, The Young Gods, Frontline Assembly, Einstürzen der Neubauten, Coil, Test Department, Fetus, Psychic TV, Chris and Cozy, De Krupps, Current 93, Nurse with Wound, Alternative Rock and Pop, Swans, Sonic Youth, Big Black, Strawberry Switchblade, The Bengals, Doctor and the Medics, Dead or Alive, The Style Council, etc. Go-Go, Trouble Funk, and I love the Junkyard Band's Sardines / The Word. Records I picked up from doing international gigs. Brazilian Drum Schools, Cantonese covers of Madonna songs. Gertie Mulzen, an elderly German woman who covered Do You Really Want to Hurt Me? And Walk on the Wild Side. Technopop, Soft Cell, Mark and the Mambas, Propaganda, Grace Jones, Pet Shop Boys, Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Spoken Word, No Entiendes, regular Karen Finley and others. New Wave, The Usual. House. I was most fond of acid, techno, and gospel house, Detroit and Chicago, and the underground treasure trove of incredibly filthy records I got from For the Record and Vinyl Mania. And obviously, hip-hop. For both house and hip-hop, For the Record and Vinyl Mania were godsends. At Danceteria, I played hardcore, Black Flag, Bad Brains, Circle Jerks, Suicidal Tendencies, Butthole Surfers, Bad Religion, Dead Kennedys, Flipper, The Misfits, Agnostic Front, etc. At Palladium, I played African, far more than Fela, though he was still part of it. New Orleans, Second Line, and Funk, and Soca, and for kitsch value, I added the funkier elements of disco to celebrate Rubel and Schrager's roots. Motown, to celebrate mine. Really, I played the disco in Motown as a joke, which was lost on everyone. This music was all embraced with a fervor that was alarming. I have no idea how much of this later music the Beasties paid attention to. By this point, they were already creating their own sound. More important, I believe, was the fact that I controlled the drink tickets. I always kept some aside for the Beasties and their crew. They no longer made requests or formed conga lines, however. I seem to recall being asked to be in a video with him, but declining because it meant I would have to wake up too early. I had priorities. I related to these boys and girls. As New York as they were, they still made perfect sense, felt comfortable, to a former Midwesterner slash Southerner. There wasn't a false note. No one was fronting. And that, I believe, was a major key to their universal appeal. They were so damned likable. At the risk of sounding drearily sentimental, everyone was so proud of them and so happy for their success because, as the Beasties evolved, they and their gang went from being precocious, beautifully mannered, high-spirited punks and punkettes, shout out here to the future luscious Jackson, into beautifully mannered, startlingly authentic and supremely creative Minches. So what was there not to love? At least, that's how I remember it.
Drink Tickets, Buffalo Gals, and Danceteria by Adam Horovitz. Read by Josh Hamilton. 1983. Buffalo Gals is the song, Danceteria is the place. It had everything we were and everything we wanted to be. Punks, rappers, breakdancers, artists, and weirdos. It was like downtown's version of Studio 54. Grown-ups hung out there doing real grown-up stuff, and us kids were fascinated being so close to it. Danceteria was the closest thing we had in Manhattan to an amusement park. It had so many options of things to get into. You didn't just go there to meet friends. It was total excitement. Even just walking up to the door. Will you get in? You're only 16, but for whatever reason, the doorman, Howie Montag, likes you, so you slide in. Once you get inside, you realize the Danceteria isn't just a club. It's an entire building, like an 8-to-10-story X-Factory building. When you're a kid, you remember the details of the places you hang out at all the time, away from home. Out in the suburbs, I guess it'd be the woods, or a parking lot, or, I don't know, the football field bleachers. For us kids in New York City, it was this particular nightclub. And so we remember all these little details, and they're important to us. The layout of Danceteria was like this. The basement was for the semi-devious. Weird stuff would go on down there. Sugar Pie DeSanto's down in the basement type stuff. But more goth. The main floor had a bar and was where bands would play. And also where Howie Montag and Anita Sarko had their monthly show, No Entiendes. At Danceteria, there was a really cool relationship between us kids and these slightly older grown-ups. And being able to go to this place felt like a privilege. I mean, shit, they'd let us in, for free no less, to see bands like The Raincoats and ESG, let us be on the dance floor all night, and even get drinks. Really, it was like a super metropolitan teen rec center. The second floor was the dance floor. Mark Kamens, making it happen. He was the first DJ I'd heard to blend in sound effects with dance music. There was a very specific dance to Danceteria. I could never get it right. My friend Noah Bogan can still do it. He pulls it out once in a while, like a drunken card trick. The Danceteria dance is similar to the textbook 80s new wave dance step, but it has a little more detail. The footwork slash floor work is a little more spread out. A kind of new romantic safety dance. Man, I wish I could do that step. Just thinking about it brings me right back to 1983. To the corner of the second floor, right by the stairwell in the back where the action was happening. Little pockets of kids and grown-ups having their own scenes, all there, separately together. Me, playing the wall, all the cool girls doing that dance step to, like, Blue Monday by New Order, or slowing the step down a little for Genius of Love by Tom Tom Club. Fucking Aquanet is in the air, everywhere. The feeling of that scene, to me, is like an open-faced peanut butter and jelly sandwich on a toasted English muffin. Wonderful. The third floor was a bar, as seen in Desperately Seeking Susan, but it also had this kind of lounge area with couches and a bunch of TV sets playing videos all night, just random stuff. It seems very 80s now to have a bunch of TVs playing random stuff, but this was the 80s, the early 80s, and as you know, a decade doesn't really kick in until the beginning of the next one, so this was ahead of its time. And it was also a weirdo place, because the only people in this video lounge area were grown-ups. Like, most nights, some grown-up would have nodded off to sleep on one of the couches. Google Spacely NY Punk. Kids wouldn't hang out in this video lounge because kids can't sit still. We'd have to sit all day in school, and we'd watch TV at home. So why would we want to go to a club to sit and watch TV? I want to be on the second floor in the corner, hanging out with girls while they did the danceteria dance. In the summertime, they'd open up the roof deck and have parties up there. And so you're 16. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. You're drinking a margarita with your friends and a bunch of grown-ups, and you're looking at the Empire State Building. It's right there, all lit up, just a few blocks away. In case I haven't made it clear yet, I'd like to spell it out here and now. I fucking love New York City. Love it. Roaches, rats, hot dogs, OTB, the one train, weird expensive watch stores, barf on the sidewalk, models with to-go coffees, all of it. Even those shitty street-sweeping Zamboni things. Love. Thank you, Mom and Dad, for having me here. There are a few floors between the roof and the third-floor video zone at Danceteria. Those were the secret floors. The no-fly zones, the get-busy spots, the get-high spots, the floors you weren't allowed to go to. I wish I could say that I used to sneak up there and get into all kinds of crazy-ass shit, but I didn't. I was still climbing over the kid's side of the fence, but I had seen over to the grown-up side. You'd think sex would be the child-slash-grown-up divide, but actually, it's drink tickets. When someone hands you a drink ticket for the first time, shit changes. You're seen differently in the eyes of someone else. The holder of the drink tickets is a person of importance, of interest. They have been put in the position of power. Whom shall I grant the right to drink for free? No way that either Howie Montag or Anita Sarko would have given me my first drink ticket. It felt more like Howie let us hang out at Danceteria because he knew we'd be safer in there than out writing graffiti or something stupid that dumb kids like us would get into. And so there we were. Summertime, 1983. On the rooftop of Danceteria, margaritas in hand, young and ready to live, looking out over the most glorious city in the world. And our friend Say gives us a future fabled quote. Wow. From up here, I can see the train station. But from down there, I can't see up here. Danceteria Playlist by Adam Horovitz, read by Josh Hamilton. The Dominatrix Sleeps Tonight, Dominatrix. This one set the standard for the Danceteria dance. When this song came on, all the kids in the second floor dance floor fell in line. If you don't own this song, go get it. Turn the lights down, maybe get a little drunk, just a little, play it, and I bet you'll instinctively start doing the Danceteria dance. Hey DJ, world's famous Supreme Team. Oddly, this song became a kind of slow jam romantic cut. This was the song he tried to dance with that special someone to. Al-Nafish, the soul, Hashim. There was a mysterious guy that would shout, "Work that body," to everyone and no one when the dance floor got hot. I never got a look at who it was, but this was the song that pushed him over the edge. Bela Lugosi's Dead, Bauhaus, the basement anthem. For a little while, there was a whole separate idea of a club in the basement of Danceteria called the Batcave. It was named and modeled after the Batcave Club in London. It was all about this new thing they're calling goth. Give Me Tonight, Shannon. This was on the heaviest of rotations on the second floor dance floor, kind of more than any other song from that era. Temptation and Blue Monday, New Order. These songs were what we wanted to be. Modern, electric, and intercontinental. Shoot You Down, APB. A punk dance floor crossover. I love it. White Horse, Laid Back. This song was for grown-ups. It got played every night, but it felt more explicit. It's weird to be 16 on a dance floor with 30-year-olds, and the song about heroin comes on, and you just keep it to yourself that the song frightens you a little. Din Da Da, George Kranz. Oh my God, stop playing this song. Every DJ in the world played this song every night. Why? It's awful. For almost half the song, the singer makes these shitty human beatbox drum roll sounds. Mark Kamens, rest in peace. If you're listening, give me some kind of sign as to why you play this record so much. Jam Hot, Johnny Dinell. Johnny Dinell, one of our own. He was a downtown DJ, and like Anita Sarko and Howie Montag, he was one of those cool grown-ups that we looked up to. And this 12-inch was gold out there on the second-floor dance floor. Hip-hop bebop, Man Parrish. This was perfect for us kids. The right sound at the right time. Drum machines and synths, pulsating and blasting. Moody, ESG. ESG was the coolest band in New York City in 83, no question. Don't Go, Yaz. Prime time dance floor material. If you want to pack a dance floor, play this song. Da Da Da, Trio. Damn, this song sounds great booming out of big club speakers. Looking for the perfect beat, Soul Sonic Force. Rap wasn't played on the dance floor at Danceteria that much. It was still relatively new, and there were only a few songs that broke through. This one, Soul Sonic Force's Planet Rock, of course. It's Like That by Run DMC, What People Do for Money by Divine Sounds, and Request Line by Rockmaster Scott and the Dynamic Three were on a short list of rap records that got spun. Buffalo Gals, Malcolm McLaren. This song was a real moment. It's what set off hip-hop downtown. Of course, The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five was the best and was what got people hip to rap, but Buffalo Gals had the elements that downtown needed, a rap sound, fashion, and a punk white dude to present it. Then Run DMC could take it from there and make rap music explode. Hungry, So Angry, Medium Medium, and Change, Killing Joke. These songs were like Snuffleupagus on Sesame Street. They only came around once in a while, but when they did, we went nuts, because these are two great songs. Money Changes Everything, Cyndi Lauper. They never played this song on the dance floor, but I put this on the list because my best friend Nadia had this tape playing in a fucking loop at the ice cream store we worked at, while we'd be rushing to close up so we could get to Danceteria. So I've heard this song 10,000 times. I love Cyndi Lauper, but I've heard this record too many times. Genius of Love, Tom Tom Club. Last song of the night. Slow in tempo. Everyone loves this and goes home happy because it is one of the greatest songs ever made.
Butthole Surfers Saved My Life by Adam Horovitz, read by me, Maya Rudolph. Literally. Well, probably. Potentially. Me and Rick Rubin went to see them play in New York City at the Ritz and ended up meeting Gibby Haynes and them hanging out for a minute outside the club. Later that night, me and Rick were at this after-hours place we used to go to called Save the Robots. I guess staying out until 4 a.m. isn't late enough in New York City. These after-hours places would start at 4 when the bars closed and go until tomorrow. Save the Robots was a grimy place in a deep basement deep in the East Village. If you saw it in a movie now, you'd swear it was fake. All kinds of drunk freaks sweating and tweaking in a stinky, graffitied basement blasting nondescript music. In 1984, the Deep East Village streets late at night would be empty, except for drug dealers, drug purchasers, and the doorman at this place. So it's 5:32 a.m. Me and Rick are done for the night, and we begin the long walk from the east side to the west. By now, the sun is starting to come out. The juxtaposition of loud, sweaty, wasted, dark basement party to completely empty, cold New York City sidewalks is jarring. It can be pretty unflattering physically and emotionally. So we leave Save the Robots. It's morning. No one's around. We're walking. And out of my peripheral vision, I notice something. I look back, and I see two teenage dudes creeping up on us. One of them is holding a huge knife, not a switchblade or something, but like a big fucking hunting style knife. I elbow Rick and he looks back. It's all split second type reactions. Neither me nor Rick is known for our hand-to-hand combat prowess. We're more known for like making beats and saying weird shit. Neither of those skills is going to help right now. And these kids are now behind us on the sidewalk, a foul line away. What the fuck do we do? Just as it's all about to go down, a huge car pulls up to the corner and stops at the red light. In that moment, I happen to notice, oh shit, it's that guy from the Butthole Surfers, Gibby. So I'm like, yo, what's up? Want to give us a ride? He's driving a two-door, but it's massive, like a beat-up mid-70s Buick Riviera. There are a ton of people in there already, but he says something to the effect of, fuck yeah, hop in. As we walk toward the car, I look back and see the two knife dudes back away and walk away. And so, yes, Butthole Surfers saved my life. Thank you.
Rush, Not the Band, by Michael Diamond. The building looked like the place where Broadway Danny Rose kept his office. It was on Broadway, in the upper 20s, near Madison Square Park. Today, real estate developers call the area Nomad. Back in the spring of 1984, it was just the cheapest place you could get an office. Anybody who could spare a few hundred bucks a month could open up shop. The neighborhood was pure chaos, an open-air market like you might find on the streets of, say, Bangkok. I'm talking dudes on every corner selling fake everything. Rolexes, perfume, anything Fila, whatever was hot. And at night, the area was a derelict ghost town. The inside was straight out of a noir detective film. All of the offices had old dark wood doors with frosted glass windows that may as well have said Sidney Falco on them. And the hallway reeked of Mr. Clean so badly that our noses burned walking in. Back in the day, Mr. Clean was a hallmark of any, lower-tiered, a.k.a. bummy, New York City building. This wasn't what we'd been expecting at all. Yauch and I were there for our first meeting with the biggest hip-hop manager on the planet, the owner of Rush Management and the man behind Curtis Blow and Run DMC, Russell Simmons. We'd gotten the meeting through Rick Rubin. Russell had been a fan of It's Yours, a record by Tila Rock and Jazzy J that Rick had produced and released. It's Yours came out at a pivotal moment in the evolution of hip-hop. In 1983, Run DMC had released their first single, It's Like That, with the B-side Sucker MCs. Before then, records on the dominant rap labels, Sugar Hill and Enjoy, had consisted of MCs rhyming over smooth drums with silky bass lines. The goal was to make music that would get played on black radio, which was then dominated by R&B. Sucker MCs changed all of that overnight. The song was incredibly basic and stripped down. Just a drum machine and rhymes. A real minimal b-boy jam and anthem. Pretty soon, that raw, programmed hand clap was blasting from every car. That shit took over, and records like Heartbeat and Rapper's Delight were instantly rendered antique. The future would not be played by musicians. It'd be programmed on TR-808, DMX, and EMU drum machines and Roland synthesizers. The future had arrived in the form of songs like It's Like That, Sucker MCs, and more to the point, It's Yours. Russell couldn't believe that somebody outside of his camp had made it, let alone a white college kid from Long Island. It's not like there were a lot of other people making hardcore hip-hop records. More exactly, there were no others. No wonder Russell wanted to meet Rick Rubin. We actually witnessed their introduction sometime in early 1984 at the bar up on the third floor of Danceteria. We were like nervous, spying children. We couldn't hear what was being said. We just watched from afar as Russell consumed multiple screwdrivers and laughed. Russell saw a future in Rick's passion for aggressive and stripped-down rap music. Rick explained us to Russell. There are these three white rappers. They're still in high school. They come from punk rock, but love hip-hop even more. All they do is listen to rap. Russell, in turn, was able to see something beyond what we could see. He saw our potential and, yes, the color of our skin, and knew that if we were any good, it could give him, as a budding rap mogul, access to all kinds of places that at the time effectively excluded underground black music. MTV, pop radio, rock music magazines like Rolling Stone, and mainstream media in general. An alliance was formed at the bar that night. Def Jam had begun in earnest. When we went to meet Russell, Rick didn't come with us to the Rush office for whatever reason. Maybe he was still asleep. He tended to sleep through the afternoon. More mysteriously, though, Mr. Adam Horovitz wasn't with us either. Maybe he was working at the ice cream spot or doing something more important, like attempting the high score on Scramble. But Yauch and I were walking on air the whole way over.
Michael, I refuse to stoop to your petty level of mirth at my expense. I'm sure I was busy that day cataloging my research at the museum. The mysteries of ancient Machu Picchu don't just uncover themselves, you know. It takes long, hard hours.
We worshipped Run-DMC. They were everything we aspired to be as rappers and musicians. And we loved pretty much every other group Russell managed, too. He seemed so fucking big time to us. The Mr. Clean smell wasn't part of the equation in our fantasy version of Russell's HQ. We'd been imagining a place more like the offices of legendary business manager to the stars, Burt Pedell, to whom Russell would